So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
For 17 years, November has been a showcase for the true nature of Men at Odds. Featuring a series that tests the will and pushes the thresholds of all who partake. It is where the frailty of the human condition fades and a raw animal instinct emerges. Many have battled to persevere. Most have failed. And as history reminds us, trust is nothing but a five-letter word. So tonight, once again, the vicious fight for survival begins.
It's Review Away. I'm John Pollock, joined as always by Wei Ting. Wei, happy Friday.
Yeah, happy to be here. So happy.
What did you do for U.S. Thanksgiving yesterday?
It's
Black Friday today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I did a ton of preparation. I stood in line. That's what I did.
There's a lot of Canadians that celebrate U.S. Thanksgiving, and I don't really know why.
There are?
You don't have any right to, unless you're American.
Why? Are there people that actually do that?
They've done it before.
I guess, like, maybe they're football fans.
Don't you remember last year at our office, they made turkey for everybody here?
Well, we do have affiliates in America.
But they were not here. This is in our Canadian office.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Thanksgiving is, you know, a pretty joyous occasion. Why not celebrate it twice?
Include everybody.
Yeah.
Maybe the whole world should celebrate Thanksgiving.
Who doesn't love turkey? Who doesn't love
Thanksgiving? No one. I think everyone loves turkey.
Yeah, who doesn't love Thanksgiving food?
Stuffing. Very good.
It's great.
I always hated all the other stuff, though, that came with it. Like the...
What?
Squash. Hate that stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Turnips. I don't want any of that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess more of the cooler Thanksgiving celebrations don't include that. All that bad stuff. Just the what do you like? Pumpkin pie?
I like pumpkin pie. I did not like pumpkin pie at all as a child, but I've grown to really like it.
How does Canadian Thanksgiving work? Because typically the pumpkin pie comes after Halloween when you've...
Well, it's still the harvest. We're still in the fall season. I mean, pumpkins are not exclusive to... Halloween doesn't own pumpkins as their gimmick.
But if I'm a typical family, I'm probably not buying too many pumpkins, okay? I'm probably buying a few pumpkins... just for decoration for Halloween, and then I might just use the actual pumpkin stuff for a pie for Thanksgiving.
But in my fantasy, you would have a giant get-together for Thanksgiving, and you'd want enough pumpkins to make this pumpkin pie for everybody. But they've eaten such a big meal, they can't have all this. So you'd have all these leftover pumpkins, and thus, what are we going to do with these pumpkins? And thus, Halloween gets jack-o'-lanterns.
Right.
That's completely made up in my head.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, so in your world...
I just created an origin story for jack-o'-lanterns on Halloween. Leftovers from Thanksgiving in Canada.
Whereas in America, perhaps pumpkin pies are the leftovers from jack-o'-lanterns.
Oh, yeah, it's very backwards.
The chicken or the egg.
I always think of Thanksgiving as before Halloween because that's how we celebrate it in Canada.
Yeah.
And as we learned on Raw Monday, no one cares about Canada and our traditions.
Nope.
You know what is a Thanksgiving tradition?
What's that?
The Survivor Series.
Yeah.
Which began in Richfield, Ohio in 1987 and returned to that state in Cleveland on November the 14th of 2004.
For what was...
The 18th annual Survivor Series.
And what was heavily billed as such throughout the show.
The 18th annual Survivor Series.
Is that accurate?
annual, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
The 18th annual. But they I don't recall them doing that since. Billing it something
last year, remember, they made a big push for, it wasn't the anniversary of the Survivor Series, but of the Undertaker. They were, you know, 25 years of the Undertaker, right, or whatever, right, that promotion was.
But I wonder why for this particular show they were so, I guess, willing to promote that the Survivor Series is 18. It's legal.
You know why, Wade? Because they looked up and down this card and they're like, what's the hook for this show? Well, this is the 18th fucking one. And that was the hook for this Survivor Series. You and I just looked, we've reviewed a lot of Survivor Series. It's kind of the downfall of the massive success of this show, Wade, is that we've been doing it for so long and reviewing so many events that when we went to go review a Survivor Series, this one was free. So we were like, sure, 2004.
Yeah.
Why not?
What could go wrong?
This show was a 2 hour and 36 minute show. The best part was clicking on it and seeing it's only 2:36. Little shorter than usual by like 10-12 minutes.
I think if you watch this show, you would be grateful for the quality, and I use that term loosely, the quality of the current 3 hour Raws. Because I don't know if this was any better than your typical 3 hour Raw.
I was going to have a guest on this show. When Christian came in recently, I was like, oh, this is perfect. When we picked this review, I'm like, he's on this show. There will be something notable. I was like, I'm not asking him a question about the 2004 Survivor Series. There's no way. There's no way he has any memory of this show, just like everybody else in this universe.
You would not sacrifice your journalistic integrity.
No, waste of a question. Sam, we were around Jim Ross this past weekend. He there is nothing to recall from this event that was noteworthy, that is worth looking back on and thinking, yeah, right, that was the night Maven came back in the main event to zero reaction. That was the show. We're going to run through this because we are troopers and we're professionals. And the song that we are going to hear, bleeding in my brain,
please,
still way.
Please, please don't. Please.
Ugly by the Exes.
I could have sworn it was Alter Bridge or
We all alone, you know, we're far from over. We're ugly. We're ugly. Why don't I do? This song was the worst way.
I mean, I guess, like, we're in 2016. We're at a time now we can look back at the past decade and kind of have a more developed, you know, probably impression of what the past, the 2000s actually were. And I guess a song like this perfectly encapsulates just how terrible music was in parts of the 2000s. I hear the song, and I just think of Affliction. I think of Affliction-type clothes.
Skulls.
Yeah.
You know what was really hammered home on this card way was, this was a year before the wellness policy was instituted. There were some bodies on this show.
Yeah.
There were some 2004 WWE bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gund Arena was the home of the Survivor Series. 7,500 people, which is not a big number for a pay-per-view.
So this is Cleveland.
Cleveland.
And I guess when their current building is the
Quicken Loans Arena,
which we were at for previous UFC. But I guess up until that point, the Gund Arena was sort of their mid-size basketball stadium.
Yeah, the Quicken Loans Arena, as we look this up, is actually the former Gund Arena. It's the same venue.
Same venue.
Yes.
So did they expand it or reconstruct it or something?
I mean, I'm looking here. I mean, that UFC card we went to, I'm pretty sure it was 18,000 people that were in there.
Yeah.
So I mean,
it's got a capacity for basketball of 20,000. 20,000.
Hockey, 10.
So what does that mean?
That's quite the range for a venue to have a 10,000 seat difference between hockey and basketball. Regardless, I know that this arena can hold more for wrestling. So 7,500 was the figure.
Huh.
Yeah, not a great number for a big pay-per-view, I will say that, regardless of the market. So the opening video focuses on the 17-year history of the Survivor Series with a dramatic voiceover. Of course, we get the shot of Bret and Shawn from 1997. Also, the conclusion of the invasion in 2001. And then the line from the voiceover guy, "Trust is nothing but a five-letter word," as Bret Hart spits in Vince McMahon's face. And then into our first of many montages to Ugly.
What? Yeah. Again, I cannot state enough how bad of a song this was. It was just everything wrong with 2000s nu metal. Everything wrong with the music of the WWE in the mid 2000s. I feel like we should be grateful. It's Thanksgiving. We should be grateful for some of the musical choices right now in the WWE, because I can guarantee you they're way better than they used to be at a time like this.
This band was formed in 1997, and this is the best line to end their little bio here. "There has been no current activity on the band front, as they have not released a statement stating otherwise. The band's future is unknown."
Great, thank you.
And they also did other stuff with WWE, such as their song "Lay Your Money Down," featured in the video game WWE SmackDown vs. Raw 2009.
Oh, I'm sure they got the entire label. What label are they on?
Ultimatum.
Okay, whatever. But I mean, like, some of their associated acts are like Papa Roach and, I'm sure some... enough. Sorry.
We get into Survivor Series, and we have the split announcers, because this was during the brand split, but no interpromotional matches on this Survivor Series. Michael Cole and Taz calling for SmackDown, and Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler for Raw.
What did you think of the set? You probably can't even remember it.
It was pretty by the numbers, nothing special about it.
It was a very bare-looking set. I don't know if they're in tougher times.
2004 was certainly a dip. You had seen the big peak in 2001 and then the decline, but the decline truly wasn't felt to me until, 2003 to 2005. You saw that. It was John Cena's emergence in 2005 that, three and four were down years, I would say, by the WWE standards of this time. And this is a very uncreative show. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing on here where I watch and it gave me curiosity to watch more around this time period or where this was going. There was one really good program going on at this time, and we will get into that. The show kicked off with a four-way cruiserweight title match with champion, the boss, Spike Dudley.
Oh, the boss.
Heel Spike Dudley.
The legit boss, Spike Dudley.
How many references on this show, such as a heel Spike Dudley, do you just have zero recollection of? Because there was so much of that on this show for me. Yeah. And
I wasn't actually watching at this time. This was sort of my dark years when I tapped out.
This was – I remember this – in this particular time period in 2004, I was in university. I had also started working at the radio station doing the law on top of that. And I just remember my mind was just – I was so busy at that time in my life. It was probably the least amount of wrestling I was watching in 2004, just piecing along.
When did the Ultimate Fighter come along?
January after this. So we're 2 months away from that.
So it was perfect timing for the UFC to hit.
Oh, they watched this show and they were like, we've got a winner, guys.
Yeah.
Right after Raw. Yeah. So Spike Dudley defending the title against Rey Mysterio, Billy Kidman, and Chavo Guerrero. Or you could say Spike Dudley against... And Rey Mysterio taking on – I had a joke here, and it's totally escaping me now. It'll come to me. Spike was – fuck this show. That was my joke. It was Spike defending the title against the 1999 WCW Cruiserweight division. I knew I had a reference. I planted it in my head when I watched this match, and I couldn't find it there for a minute.
Yeah, okay.
Spike is a shirtless heel wearing brown cargo pants.
And what was Billy Kidman wearing? He came out – I mean, I think we all like think of Kidman quite fondly. We think of him for his WCW run, the tank top, the jean shorts. Looked kind of cool for him. Here, the WWE 2004 version of Kidman was dressed in a bedazzled red jacket, these red generic trunks – and just a very generic-looking haircut. It looked nothing like the Kidman I have in my mind.
Yeah, he was involved in a tag team with Paul London, and they had just had a SmackDown pay-per-view prior to this where they had an awesome match. But Kidman never found much success in this WWE Cruiserweight division.
And a heel Kidman right now.
Yeah, a heel Kidman as well, who had just there was a feud brewing with him and Chavo because he had botched a shooting star press and landed on Chavo, and they showed the replay of this, giving Chavo a concussion. We also had Billy Kidman's WWE theme. Did you remember this one, Wade? This was not a bright time for music.
Yeah, I think CFOs were what, like probably two at the time. I don't know. They were sort of.
There was some bad music on this show, like entrance wise, like some just generic shit too.
And like, if there's anything to be said about, you know, like what those guys are doing right now for some of the NXT crop is how much over a lot of the guys are solely because of their entrances and because of the music. And if you think what they could have done for somebody like a Billy Kidman, if there was a better entrance theme, it actually could have made a big difference.
There was a good sequence between Chavo and Ray when they were in there together. Ray hit a Hurricane Rana off the top to Kidman from the edge of the apron. And then Chavo caught Ray and threw him over the top for a senton onto Kidman on the floor. Spike went for a pescado but missed everybody and just crashed on the floor. Kidman and Chavo, this is where they're going over their feud after the concussion. There was a Tower of Doom spot with Kidman on the bottom and Chavo with a superplex to Spike. Then he hit the BK bomb to Ray.
Burger. It sounds like a sandwich.
That's all you can
sandwich.
With a side of fries. And then he drags him over for the shooting star press and gets sent off by Chavo. Ray then stops the Dudley Dog into the 619. Mm-hmm. Kidman then yanks Ray off the apron before a springboard. Chavo hits the Gory Bomb and Kidman breaks that with a leg drop. Ray with a leg scissors takes him and Kidman to the floor as Spike pins the prone Chavo at 9:03. And Chavo is clutching his head as could be dealing with a secondary blow, right, as we were right into the concussions as just a working injury that Chavo was going through at the time.
Mm. Yeah, for all the negativity I guess we've spewed so far about the show, I actually thought this match was quite good. I think all four men, there's no questioning their talent. And, you know, somebody like Spike, who doesn't typically work this type of style, I thought fit in quite well. They're all working really fast. I thought their coordination was really good. And I was also impressed by, you know, how much heat they were able to build for that shooting star press. Got a big reaction from the crowd for the tease. They told that story quite well. And I also was impressed by Cole and Taz at this time, who I think were actually standouts of this show. I thought they sounded great together, able to keep up with that very fast pace.
And this Cruiserweight division, I mean, hardly a glowing success in 2004, but I mean, this felt people were a lot more into this than a lot of the Cruiserweight matches we see at the moment. Paul Heyman is with John Heidenreich. Yes, Heyman was paired with John Heidenreich. You could not possibly make me remember this alliance.
A Paul Heyman guy that doesn't really get brought up.
He's pumping up Heidenreich, saying that the Undertaker goes down tonight, and then Heyman goes to get his jacket and leaves the shot as Snitsky walks in. And this was a Raw SmackDown interaction on this pay-per-view.
This was probably the most notable part of this show, at least the part of the show that still gets brought up as a meme to this day.
I just pictured Vince McMahon producing this segment. And Snitsky walks up. They growl at one another. Snitsky says, "I like your poetry." And Heidenreich says, "I like what you do to babies." It was the Raw going into the show where it was the famous punt into the crowd of the baby. And he says, "I'll see you later. I'll see you soon, Snitsky." And as ridiculous as this sounds in hindsight, 12 years removed, these two, in similar roles that they were serving on each brand, the idea at this time was these two monsters would join together to face The Undertaker and Kane at WrestleMania before that idea was shelved. God. They had big plans for these two, which were not met.
Yeah, I guess the show, I mean, the fact that these two guys were positioned to be in such prime roles, I think also goes to show just the mindset of the company and, of course, of Vince McMahon.
Snitsky was a significantly higher priority in that main event scene than Jericho, than Benoit.
Eddie.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. It was like – this was kind of the mindset. It was – look at some of the monsters you had on this show. Like this was the era of big guys, jacked up, your Luther Reigns, your Snitskys, your Heidenreichs.
All these guys.
This was the epitome of it. And you were coming off a year and title reigns for Eddie and Benoit where you thought there was the shifting focus, and this was the drastic kind of back to reality mode for the company. Batista was getting heated up. Now, that was a guy that had charisma, but it was the same kind of mindset. I mean, Hunter jacked on this show. I mean, that was the order of the day in the WWE, and this show was a perfect glimpse at that mindset.
Yeah, and even a sketch like this where they're kind of poking fun of these two ridiculous characters, I don't think it's something that they would do today. Like, you can look at a guy like Braun Strowman, who I think is of the very same mold as a guy like this. But Braun Strowman, I think, is treated with a lot more care. And that's why, like, on was it a week ago or something?
Braun Strowman, the
scarves? Yeah. Braun Strowman was involved in something that could have been comedic, but he didn't.
He was around the comedy. He wasn't the comedy. Right. These two were the comedy.
Yeah. So I think even, you know, if you had a Heidenreich or a Gene Snitsky character today, they'd probably be treated and booked a lot better. And maybe they would have worked better.
Tough to say.
Yeah.
Especially Snitsky. I cannot hear this guy's name without – I mean, you would have never heard it on the radio, obviously. Dan Lavransky never, ever called this guy by his right name. Except on the air.
What do you call him?
What do you think he called him? Shelton Benjamin and Christian were next for the Intercontinental title. And Lawler notes that Jeff Garcia and LeBron James may be in the arena tonight. And therefore, Shelton isn't the best pure athlete in the arena. What a sales job by Lawler. Mm-hmm. As Jim Ross disagrees and thinks that Shelton is better.
Better than LeBron, I don't know.
Shelton over LeBron.
Maybe.
I mean, Shelton brought a championship to Cleveland before LeBron did here with the IC title.
That is true.
Christian slaps him. Oh, Christian came out, and this was when he was starting to use the waterproof blonde theme that was a nice change from the Christian at last you're on your own theme.
That one was, I think, was his best, though. The Christian at last you're on your own, the choir one.
I like that one, but I like this one a lot, too. And he had Tomko as the sidekick.
So you could have had a question for him about this show.
Tell us about waterproof blonde.
Yeah.
I would like to know what a waterproof blonde is. Like, what does that mean?
A blonde that doesn't get wet.
From anything? Like, is there a sphere that they have?
Again, a question you could have asked.
You're right. I really did drop the ball. So Christian is out. I always thought him and Tomko, they had really good chemistry of, like, the... Very much in the Shawn Michaels Diesel role of the big guy that had some personality to him. And I did bring that up with Christian about working with Tomko and the Tomko give me a beat, which is a line he still hears to this day.
Okay.
When they did the battle rap.
And we'll hear that interview Sunday.
Sunday on The Law. Gotcha. You will hear it. And we'll also be coming to our Law YouTube channel that you can subscribe to now. And you must. YouTube.com/liveaudiowrestling. Christian slaps him, and Shelton responds with a closed fist, which raised the ire of Jim Ross, noting that Earl Hebner should admonish him for using a closed fist. Benjamin hit a springboard blockbuster. Then Christian went for a monkey flip with Benjamin landing on his feet and then an Oklahoma roll for a two count. And Lawler questioned why it's called an Oklahoma roll, and Ross explained, well, it just always has. Tomko pulls Benjamin down to the floor. Christian gets the advantage, raked his eyes, and then Tomko runs him back first into the apron behind the referee's back. And then Christian worked on him, hit a spinning inverted neck breaker, and calls him a flash in the damn pan. Three-time IC champion, you son of a bitch. And then Benjamin did a slingshot reverse suplex using the rope to bounce Christian off. And then Benjamin missed with a stinger splash and takes an implant DDT, Christian getting a two count. Tomko slides the title into the ring, distracts Hebner. Christian grabs the title but gets kicked in the face by it. And Hebner's trying to wrestle it away. And Benjamin flies off the turnbuckle, gets a two count. Tomko then landed a big boot as Hebner is busy removing the title from the ring, gets a near fall on Christian. And then an enziguri sends Tomko off the apron. Christian goes for the unprettier. It's blocked. And then he went for this T-Bone suplex into a power slam for the win at 13 minutes and 24 seconds. And in 2004, this was after they had broken up World's Greatest Tag Team, and Shelton Benjamin was certainly poised to be the next one of the next breakout stars, and that was certainly evident from JR's commentary because he labeled him as having superstar potential and saying we're going to see big things from him and he's becoming something extraordinary. Like, he went above and beyond putting emphasis on Shelton Benjamin as that next level of star, which was never really realized with Shelton.
Why would you say, what do you think were the primary factors for that?
I think he was, I mean, he was a really good performer at that time period in the WWE.
I'm sure he still is.
Yeah, but I mean, when you went and saw him go to Japan, I mean, when you were in with that level, I mean, he wasn't the standout he was at this time period. And I think, you know, he didn't have that, the interview ability, the personality. I think that hurt him at times. And he also got some awful shit thrown at him, like that Mama Benjamin stuff where they came out with these just stupid ideas to try and get him over. I mean, he had a good career, but nowhere at the – I mean, you listen to this commentary. I mean, he was poised like this was their Sting on the way up. Like, this was Sting circa 89 or something.
That should have been his gimmick, the Black Sting.
Oh, he did. He was – I mean, he always said Sting was like the guy he wanted to emulate. He did the Stinger Splash. That was one of his moves.
Right. And what's the latest on him coming back?
He had his shoulder surgery, so he's probably a few months out now. And
is there a need for him now? It's kind of a different landscape than, I guess, initially from the brand split when they thought that they would need a lot more bodies.
I would imagine the door is going to be open just because it was at one point that he'll come in. But yeah, it's tough to make room for a guy at his age now.
Could he be a cruiserweight?
Mm. He's not that small of a guy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's closing in on 40 now as well. Kurt Angle is backstage, and he finds Edge, who is having some coffee. And Kurt has just read Edge's book, and it talked about Kurt nearly bleeding to death while naked. And he didn't want to be portrayed that way in Edge's book. That famous story way of Kurt Angle nearly bleeding to death naked. And I've read Edge's book. I do not remember this.
I think there's probably a lot worse about Kurt Angle if you Google the man, unfortunately.
Angle asks about the chapter in his book about winning the title. And then he realizes, oh, yeah, you've never done that, Edge. And then points out at Taboo Tuesday how Edge lost out in the voting, the fan voting, to Shawn Michaels. And says he took out Shawn Michaels, unlike you, Kurt. And Angle goes to leave, and then he walks into Eugene, who is a big fan of Kurt's. And Kurt says, you're good, very quick. And then when he points out his Olympic accolades, Eugene starts singing, you suck, and Angle leaves.
Yeah, the Eugene character.
And who would have thought that these two would have a match at SummerSlam the next year?
Hmm.
Kurt Angle and Eugene.
Yeah, what did you think of Eugene?
I think it's a character that if you go back and watch, I mean, this guy was enormously popular when he was first introduced, like super popular, and had – it was a short shelf life, and then they – he really – like they – he was very popular, and then they booked him against Hunter, and Hunter beat him. And then he kind of just trailed off into the mid-card, and I think now if you go back and watch it, there was definitely – it's not a character you could put on TV today angering a lot of people. Probably.
I thought he did do a great job of it though.
A guy who was just strictly technical wrestler, Nick Dinsmore, who had to play this completely different character. I mean, he played it. He was all in on the character, 100%. And maybe it could have had more, but I mean, for that summer of 2004, when they brought him in the spring and throughout the summer up to SummerSlam, I mean, he had a pretty good following. He was one of the top, most popular acts on Raw.
And he's a trainer now, right? Dinsmore?
He's a trainer. I think now at OVW and still does independence. Then we had this random WrestleMania recall. This was the only one of the whole show showing Austin and Michaels from 98. And this leads to Michael Cole announcing that the Staples Center sold out in a minute for WrestleMania. And Taz predicts it's going to be a great show next year. WrestleMania 21. Then we go to our first Survivor Series elimination match. It's Kurt Angle, Luther Reigns, Carlito, and Mark Jindrak taking on The Big Show, Rob Van Dam, Eddie Guerrero, and the returning John Cena, who had been off taping a movie, The Marine, actually, I believe he was taping in Australia, and to cover for his absence way, was stabbed in a bar by Carlito and Jesus.
It's quite the injury.
It was even worse because that angle was done just a few weeks after a TNA wrestler, Johnny Devine, was legit stabbed.
Oh, yeah.
In kind of, and there are very few coincidences in professional wrestling, and that was certainly.
Have you ever talked to Johnny Devine about that?
Yeah, yeah, I have.
And obviously he was not happy.
No, he's he did an interview with me talking about this, and he also did a recent one on Art of Wrestling. And yeah, he was upset about this because he thought this was a direct copy of his real life stabbing.
Where he almost died.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was yeah, and there was a line about the stabbing later in a in a segment backstage. So Kurt Angle and his new team, replacing Charlie Haas and Shelton Benjamin, were Luther Reigns and Mark Jindrak. Quite the trade.
Yeah.
And they had attacked Big Show, and they had injured his ankle and shaved his hair off. So Big Show comes out, and to sell the injured ankle way, he's wearing a boot, and the boot has tape over it.
Ridiculous.
Sorry, go ahead.
I know this was the most ridiculous visual. I know you want to show off the injury. What the? Who in their right mind would believe? Why would you tape a boot? a hard rubber boot.
I'm just looking this up, actually. Shelton Benjamin's 41 years old. He doesn't look it. Yeah, so the boot is taped on the left ankle. Eddie Guerrero is the captain, which is very weird because his feud with Kurt had ended and now Kurt was feuding with Big Show. And Eddie was just, to me, a random part in this match. Like, Cena had the issue with Carlito. Eddie and Van Damme were kind of just guys in this match. And Eddie had been – this was 2004. This was his biggest year up until this point. And he just – he came out with this new shirt, which was based off a Tabasco bottle.
Yeah, the Tabasco logo, yeah.
Yeah,
it said Latino Heat. It's not a bad shirt.
Would you have bought it?
Maybe.
Actually,
I mean, of all the choices, I don't think that's one of the worst ones.
Cena charges at the ring. This was his first return since the attack by Jesus, Aaron Aguilera, who was Carlito's bodyguard. And they go immediately to the backstage area. And this was done because Carlito had just suffered a bad shoulder injury and he could not work. So they took care of Carlito immediately. So they're in the back. Jimmy Corderas tries to stop Cena. And Cena lifts Corderas and just flies him into this trunk in the back area.
Biggest bump I've seen Jimmy take.
He left his feet here.
Yeah.
This was nuts. Carlito's bleeding. It wasn't me. In the parking lot, as Jesus attacks Cena from behind in his ridiculous red pants with suspenders. And he was dressed as Andrade, Cien Almas.
Oh, I'm guessing it's a look somewhere. You know, I'm guessing it's more commonplace.
Suspenders.
Yeah.
And they sent this woman out of a car, and then Carlito and Jesus, fresh off the stabbing, now committed a Grand Theft Auto here, and took off in the car as Cena returned to the ring and the match officially started.
Cena tried to smash the car window with his bare hands multiple times.
I hope that was gimmick glass and he wasn't doing a Goldberg.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Then we had maybe the line of the entire pay-per-view as Michael Cole had to bring us all up to speed on what was going on with Kurt Angle and the Big Show, where Cole explained how Angle, quote, just listen to this entire sentence, raped Big Show of his dignity and broke his ankle after shooting him with a tranquilizer dart, which was the exact angle. And the line about raping him of his dignity was a callback to a Killer Khan, Andre the Giant angle, where that was the same line used. Yes, they used a tranquilizer dart. Like, he, like, Angle had a crossbow on TV and shot Big Show like a bear that then just stumbled down onto the mat, and then they shaved his head and put him in the ankle lock.
I mean, it's, boy.
Tranquilizer dart angles. Yeah. You can only do those once in a generation.
Well, and then you do a stabbing the next month.
Yeah, SmackDown was kind of nuts at this time. This is also when Tough Enough was going on, which had Daniel Puter involved with the angle segment. Mm. SmackDown was just wild times here. So there was a phantom dropkick by Eddie to Luther Reigns, and then a Greco-Roman knuckle lock into a head scissors off the top to Reigns and Jindrak. Angle and Guerrero are in, and a very noticeable difference when these two were in, as they got the heat on Guerrero. Taz just schools Michael Cole on what a butterfly suplex is, explaining it as a double underhook applied by Kurt Angle. Guerrero then finally hits this head scissors, tags in Van Damme. Jindrak tries to pull Angle away from a frog splash and then takes it himself, and Angle rolls up RVD using the ropes to eliminate Van Damme, and the bell didn't ring at first, but he was eliminated. Guerrero then rolls up Jindrak and uses the ropes for leverage for the elimination immediately afterwards. Then Reigns clips the bad ankle of Big Show, is caught with a choke slam, and Show eliminates Reigns, so it's down to 3-on-1 with Kurt Angle all by himself. Show's choke slam is countered into an ankle lock onto the bad angle, but Big Show does a roll through, sending Angle to the floor, and Angle is getting ready to leave, but RVD comes back and chases him back into the ring, into the Big Show, who gets tossed into a Cena FU. Then Guerrero hits the frog splash, and Big Show pins Kurt at 12 minutes and 27 seconds, so the babyfaces survive, minus Rob Van Dam, after having the numbers advantage on Kurt.
It was a little tough for me to get into the match without really knowing the context of a lot of the storylines that they were playing, so I can only really comment on the match itself. And, you know, I think the standout portions were the fact were just how over John Cena was at this time. And,
honestly, and all positive reactions, too.
Yep, all positive. And honestly, not that much else.
Yeah, this was so quick. 12:27 for a 4-on-4 elimination match. And coming out of this, they would flip the title because of Carlito's injury. Cena beat him clean in the comeback on that week's SmackDown. Mm. They showed a promo for WWE 24/7 on demand, the way of the future. Jonathan Coachman is with Maven backstage and asks, "Do you have a chance, or do you even deserve to be in this match?" And Maven is offended by this line of questioning. And then he gets sneak attacked by Snitsky from behind and thrown into the set equipment. And in comes Fit Finlay and Steve Kern to check on Maven, who is busted wide open from this throw into the equipment and is bleeding.
Yeah, a lot less worries about blood at this time.
Yeah, they were just bleeding all over everybody in this. And theoretically, Maven's status now up in the air for the Survivor Series elimination match later, where he was on Team Orton. Then there was a feature on Heidenreich, including attacking fans and making them cry, and then putting The Undertaker into a hearse, and then getting into a Bronco and driving the Bronco into the hearse, which then exploded. But Taker arose from.
Oh, God. Like, if it,
like, I have zero desire to go back and watch any of this.
Sometimes, like, I'm hearing you recap a lot of these ridiculous angles, and I feel like you could have replaced a lot of these names with some names from WCW in 2000, and I wouldn't have thought any different.
The best was Taker's response, because at the Survivor Series, he's not coming to beat Heidenreich. He vows to, quote, execute him. Execute him. So maybe he was going to bring a rifle to the ring. Heidenreich's entrance alongside Paul Heyman. I mean, this was right out of ECW 93-94, where Sabu would be wheeled to the ring or in a straitjacket. I mean, that seems to be the total influence here of Heidenreich. It was like a mesh of Sabu and 911 together as a character. That looked to
really?
Be Heidenreich.
Do you think this was Paul Heyman's idea?
I'm sure it was an idea thrown at him. And Paul Heyman is – Heidenreich's entrance theme is Paul Heyman repeatedly saying Heidenreich. Heidenreich. Heidenreich.
I feel like it could have worked if the guy didn't look so goofy.
He did look very goofy, and he had some awful tattoos as well.
His face was just, along with Gene Snitsky, it was just like, it felt incredibly cartoony, way too cartoony to be intimidating.
So Heidenreich and The Undertaker. Heyman was sporting a ponytail with this beige jacket in 2004. Cole notes that he doesn't want anything more to do with Heidenreich. This after another famous segment in 2004, where you can watch that on the network. It was a very creepy scene. Taker scares Brian Hebner, the referee, to the floor as he attacks Heidenreich with strikes and into a Kimura, driving him into the turnbuckle. And then Heidenreich hits a low blow as Heyman distracts the referee and then crotches him on the post. Taker hits a leg drop onto the edge of the apron, follows with old school. The crowd was into Taker's offense. He goes for the running boot in the corner, and he totally misses the Taker Huluva kick into the corner. And, I mean, all credit to this guy. I mean, not surprising he's had hip issues afterwards. But look at this. I mean, he just ran right into this corner with the big boot.
Taker was moving so fast.
I know.
So well here. And to think that I feel like, you know, at this stage – everybody is so desperate for a good Undertaker performance, and to think that he was wasting his abled body on matches like this in 2004 is a bit of a tough watch.
Taker gets knocked off the apron to the floor and then into the barricade as Heidenreich is back in control. Then Taker snapped his neck on the top, followed with a top rope clothesline, snake eyes, big boot, and a leg drop for a two count. And then Heidenreich catches him with a spinning side slam, is punching him in the corner when Taker lifts him, hits the last ride, and Heidenreich grabs the bottom rope to save himself. And the story is that the Undertaker cannot put Heidenreich away. And Taz then plays Joe Rogan.
Undertaker's in the center of the
ring. Watch out, watch out!
Oh, reverse kick into a side suplex of his own.
Actually, a back suplex and turning Heidenreich inside out there.
Correcting Michael Cole when he calls it a back suplex, and he says it was a side suplex. And then Taker hits a flying clothesline, hits a choke slam, staggers up to his feet, and finally Undertaker hits the tombstone for the win at 15:55. And the announcers did a lot to put Heidenreich over here of how much it took to beat him. I don't know what the legs were on this program. I will say, though, when we picked this, I saw the length of this match, and I was dreading this. And this was not as bad as I thought. Sure. I mean, Taker worked a lot better with Heidenreich than I thought. And, I mean, Heidenreich was not great, but he was not – I've seen worse with The Undertaker of big monsters that could do a whole hell of a lot less. It was a physical match.
He was not Kali. He was not Giant Gonzalez.
No.
But I was actually very impressed with The Undertaker here. He, like I said, was working incredibly fast. And, you know, all in all – not really memorable whatsoever, but, you know, Heidenreich to me just kind of seemed like a very generic big guy.
Maria is with Eric Bischoff backstage, and the story was Eric Bischoff is going on vacation for the next month because the winning Raw team in the elimination match, each member of the team gets to run Raw for 1 week.
Gotcha.
So there were stakes on the line with a month of repercussions. And he's asked about Maven's status for tonight. He says he may not be able to compete, and when asked who will be his replacement, stating he is not getting involved in any of that, because if he names a replacement, Hunter's team is going to protest, and his vacation to Hawaii will be canceled, because then he's going to have to go explain himself to the board of directors. So fuck Orton's team. I'm out of here. And that was the last we would see of Eric Bischoff. Then there was a video package for the women's title match. This was all of Trish's heel work, calling Lita a slut, Lita having Kane's baby, the Snitsky chair shot.
Trish playing a heel to this extent was also, I think, something that I don't often think about when I think about Trish Stratus, but I thought, at least in highlight form, she seemed to do a great job.
She was an excellent heel in 2004. And she comes out defending the women's title against Lita. There was a sign that read, Trash Stratus. And Stratus is mocking Lita being heavy on her way to the ring.
Yeah.
This is probably not a storyline that Charlotte or Sasha or Bailey will be having.
Although I could see it. I mean, yes, it's kind of like...
I don't think they will ever touch a pregnancy angle with the women.
Oh, sorry, not the pregnancy thing, but to make fun of somebody for their weight. I could see a heel doing that.
So Lita immediately punches her and continues with punches. And Trish escapes to the floor. They fight ringside, and Trish gets driven face first into the chair at ringside. And then Lita attacks with the chair that really didn't come close to hitting Trish. And the DQ is called at a minute 21,
mm-hmm.
shorter than Lesnar Goldberg number 2 at Survivor Series. And Lita continues on the attack. Trish is bleeding from the nose, and it had the Ric Flair effect where the blood was all going into her blonde hair to make it look even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And the officials are helping Trish. There was this great shot of Lita nailing her from behind as she got sent into the steps. Lita chant throughout the arena as they're escorted to the back. JR is apologizing for the graphic nature of this nosebleed. And Trish is furious. Later in the show, JR would say that Trish broke her nose and she'd start wearing a faceplate after this.
No.
And this would lead in a couple of weeks to the Raw main event with these two. And was probably the wiser choice at the time than just doing the big match here on Survivor Series. They ended up headlining a Raw in December.
Yeah, no match, but the angle I thought was tremendous. A lot of heat for this.
This was one of the better things on the show, I felt.
Yes. It might have been the best.
It might have been.
And, you know, blood with women is still something that I think, I mean, obviously up until that point, but even today, even more rare that we get to see. So it definitely caught my attention. And I thought Trish and the cameras and the producers and the directors did a great job of showing that visual off.
Then we go backstage, and it's Eddie Guerrero and his teammates. And this is where he's checking on Cena's back and notes.
Uh-oh. Man, I was checking out your back. I can see there's a scar there.
Yeah, man, the doctors hooked it up.
You don't even have a scar. And Cena says how, quote, the doctors hooked it up.
Uh-oh. Jeez.
What a miracle recovery. A stabbing with no scar.
The doctors.
We had to explain that there will be no graphic representation of this angle for the future of John Cena and how we will explain a stabbing angle with a man that works shirtless.
What did they hook him up with exactly?
I guess a plastic surgeon.
Okay.
Teddy Long comes in and he sends off Big Show, Guerrero, and Van Damme to speak with Cena. Big Show, while leaving, leaves his towel with Cena. And Cena calls it sick. So as we can see, from Big Show to Enzo, some things never change in WWE way. And Teddy Long congratulates him on his speedy recovery. And Cena complains that Carlito stole his chain and belt. So the stabbing wasn't even the top issue Cena had with Carlito. And he makes the match for SmackDown this Thursday for the U.S. title, or else Carlito will be stripped. And that's when we got this line of dialogue from John Cena in 2004 when it was still rapper Cena. His response.
Yo, slow your roll, man. You can't mess with me like this. I think I know where you're going, but you can't play with my emotions.
Yo, slow your roll, man. You can't mess with me like this. I think I know where you're going, but you can't mess with my emotions, bro. Mind you. Cena is stating this to Teddy Long while wearing his Word Life boxer briefs during this exchange. He is in his underwear talking to Teddy Long. I watched this segment, and it did not stun me at all that there was a backlash to this guy a few months later. Like, they were positioning him as Mark Wahlberg, right down to, like, the Calvin Klein underwear model.
Funky Bunch Mark Wahlberg.
Exactly.
Yes.
Like, that's who this guy felt like watching this. And I was watching this guy. I was like, no wonder there was a dislike of this guy to a certain segment.
Yeah, but was the backlash as a result of exactly this, though? Because I feel like this was probably him still in his babyface prime.
It was the same, I feel, as Roman, where at a certain level, everyone liked him. Like, Cena was super popular at this time in 2004. He was doing the freestyles. And then you moved him into a position where I think people felt he wasn't ready at this level yet. And in-ring, he wasn't. But personality-wise, 100% he was. He was a great character, much more than I think Roman is. But once you get to that level, I think that there is a certain backlash when people think you're above where they view you if it's too fast.
He reminded me of a juiced up Justin Bieber in a scene like this.
God, how old would Justin Bieber have been in this era?
I don't know.
04.
Two.
There was a video for the WWE title match on SmackDown between JBL and Booker T. And Booker was the first guy to pin JBL since prior to WrestleMania when JBL switched into this character. And he did it in a tag match to get his opportunity. And then Booker beat Orlando Jordan to confirm the title shot. And JBL has vowed he will leave SmackDown forever if he does not retain the WWE title.
What was Josh Matthews' involvement in this feud?
He was just one of the announcers that they were looking to get more involved in. I mean, he had been hired off of Tough Enough. Mm-hmm. And then it served as a... as an announcer, he was calling shows and backstage announcer. And at this time, they looked to be utilizing him more, and he would get involved in this. Booker comes out, and he's wearing these yellow hand wraps as Orlando Jordan is in the corner of JBL. They went to the floor. Booker got sent onto the announce desk, and Jordan is constantly attacking Booker from behind while Nick Patrick is tending to JBL. JBL's in control, very slow-paced at the start. Booker hit a superplex, then fought Jordan on the floor and sent him into the post and hit a bookend to JBL on the floor and then delivered a super kick to Jordan, which led to a Booker T chant. Booker climbed to the top and missed with a Harlem hangover, and then he sets up for a scissors kick, gets tripped by Jordan from the floor as JBL hits a DDT for a two count. There's a reverse Irish whip as JBL is run into Nick Patrick. So Jordan comes in. He's attacking Booker. Jordan gets a chair when Josh Matthews charges in, knocks the chair into Jordan, but then gets killed by JBL and gets sent to the floor. Booker fires back, hit a scissors kick. The referee is still out. Charles Robinson runs in. He counts two, but Jordan yanks him to the floor and then hits the bookend to Jordan and runs in with the title. JBL grabs the title, hits Booker with the belt shot, and JBL pins Booker at 14:45.
It felt like a good execution, this match, of a pretty typical WWE pay-per-view match. Lots of interference, big reactions for comebacks, but ultimately the heel comes out on top. I can't say it was all that memorable.
It was just a match to me. I think today, you see matches at this level every week on
yep.
TV. So it was a match. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. It was the Survivor Series 2004. It did happen. Hunter, Batista, and Ric Flair are backstage. This was after, to set up this story, this was after the breakup, the kicking out of Randy Orton from Evolution the night after SummerSlam when he won the title. And then, for whatever reason, they put the title on Orton, and then he lost it to Hunter 3 weeks later on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
And that, at the time, we thought was the match they were building towards for WrestleMania. It would be Hunter and Orton, and then you did the match in September, and somehow during this time, Batista caught fire, and he ended up being the program, which was the right choice. Mm-hmm. Hunter, Batista, and Ric Flair are in the locker room, and Batista's talking to Hunter, and they were so great with these subtle hints. And this one was Batista tapping Hunter's title. And Hunter just looks down with this, who the fuck are you touching my title look?
Mm.
And he says that he will get to run Raw for 2 weeks. And then Edge and Snitsky, they explain they won't be able to run anything because of what they'll put them through, Hunter and Batista, when they run Raw. And Batista waits for Hunter to leave. And he tells Rick that he can't wait until it's his night to run Raw, with the idea, is Batista going to go after his teammate's title when he has control of the show?
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a video package. The best part of this was there's a, the glory shot of Hunter with the title holding it up as there's a fan sign right behind him that reads Samoa Joe, the real world champion. In 2004. Snitsky says that he's coming for Hunter's title. Edge says the same. And there's a shot of Hunter telling Batista to go speak to Edge and Snitsky. And as Hunter leaves, Batista is left alone with the title. And he just grabs it and looks at it. Mm-hmm. This stuff was, I mean, as we talk about this time period in WWE, this was hands down the best stuff. And this was one of the best built programs this company has done in the last 15 years. This was tremendous, I thought. And then we go into our Xyz montage of everyone killing everyone. Weapons, blood, everything. And that takes us to our main event. It is Triple H, Batista, Edge, and Snitsky against Randy Orton, Chris Jericho, and Chris Benoit, with Maven absent for the match to start. And there was a sign in the crowd that read, "Haha, Batista can't get over," which was incorrect.
Hmm.
And Orton comes out to that theme music that he has stated over and over he hated. And this was a really awkward shift because Randy Orton was a really great heel, and he struggled as a babyface and ended up losing the WrestleMania slot because he did not catch fire as a babyface. And, I mean, watching him in this match, I mean, he did not feel like your top babyface.
I think you could have said that same thing even, you know, up until a couple months back. You know, I feel like this current run where he's kind of a pseudo heel, but I feel like with the rise of the meme and the RKO thing, he's probably a better babyface now than he was.
It started early on. Benoit got tagged in and hit the rolling Germans to Hunter, and then he did a snap suplex to Edge on top of Hunter, and then hit a double flying headbutt to both guys. He applies the sharpshooter to Hunter, and Snitsky saves, and then a crossface to Edge. Hunter then hits Benoit with the pedigree, and Edge pins him, so Hunter gets the credit, and Benoit is the first elimination. Hunter and Snitsky are arguing, and Hunter shoves him down, and Batista and Snitsky go forehead to forehead as Jericho applies the walls to Hunter, but Batista breaks it up. And then Flair, who's on the floor in their corner, stops a Jericho lion salt, and Flair gets ejected from ringside by Mike Chioda. Orton then nailed Batista with a belt shot from the floor. Jericho then hits an enziguri, and Jericho eliminates Batista. So it's now 3-on-2 with Batista gone, Benoit gone. Jericho hit a sling blade to Edge. They got the heat on Jericho. And then Snitsky had some trouble grabbing hold of Orton to throw him to the floor. And this is when Maven played Terry Funk, coming back with a bandaged forehead, bleeding. To, like, this was all built around this big return for Maven. Total, like, the visual of him bleeding here. He comes in, he fires up on everybody. This crowd could not care.
No.
Because it was Maven. I mean, they tried their best on this show to make him like the big savior of this team. And
why?
Hey.
Why him of all the people in this match?
Another guy who was just jacked.
He was just, he wasn't that jacked in comparison. I mean,
in comparison to others, I get it, but on his own.
But I guess on the babyface team, he was the pet project.
Yeah, I mean, they had been. When he came off Tough Enough, he was very popular for a couple of months, and then he kind of just fell to the wayside. And then in this time period, they kind of just decided, hey, let's go with him after doing nothing with him for 2 years. And, yeah, it didn't quite take, to say the least. Mm. So Maven comes down. He fires up on everyone. Snitsky comes in. One of the guys who he fired up on was Snitsky, and he busted him open. I think he, like, broke his orbital bone because the cut – you could see the cut. It looked awful. Like, this looked like a cut you would have seen in a
MMA
fight. Like, it looked brutal. He's bleeding all over, and he gets a chair. And to say the least, Snitsky did not ease up on this chair because he sent Maven's head down into his liver.
Pretty much.
He hit it hard.
Yeah.
And he's dead, and Snitsky is DQ'd. So this was the monster they protected in this one was Snitsky, and then hit a chair shot to the back of Randy Orton. No way Orton was taking that one to the head. And then Hunter pins Maven from the chair shot. Meanwhile, Jericho's out on the floor. He's rolled in. He kicks out of a count by Edge, and then he gets speared by Edge and eventually is eliminated. So it's down to Hunter and Edge against Orton, 2-on-1. During this exchange, Lawler notes that Randy Orton's father was a snake.
Okay.
The future Viper. Now we know his origin. And they double-team Orton with stomps. Orton ducks, clotheslines Edge into Hunter, sends him off the apron, and then there's a roll-up for a two-count and returns. Orton takes a spinebuster from Hunter, and then Edge is setting up for a spear, goes to hit Orton, but misses, and he spears Hunter, turns around into an RKO, and Orton eliminates Edge. And the crowd picked up noticeably here as he's chanting RKO. And Hunter then blocks an RKO, low blows Orton. And then from there, Hunter sets up for the pedigree. Orton escapes. And as Ross describes it, hits an RKO out of nowhere to Triple H and wins at 24-32. So based on this way, I mean, the big tease was Batista, but they were certainly going all in with Randy Orton. So I don't know when the decision was made that they switched it up, but Batista, I think, was just a short-term thing that they would pay off. And I don't think at this time in November they anticipated that being the WrestleMania main event. But it was not long before they realized the money is in Batista.
Hmm.
So your thoughts on this main event?
Yeah.
Cool. So Orton poses. He celebrates in the ring to close the show, and his team controls Raw for the next 4 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I for me, the show is kind of just tough to watch without really any investment in the current storylines. I feel the matches on their own didn't do a whole lot to capture my attention. They're just simply nothing memorable. But it's neat to see guys like Orton in earlier stages of their careers.
I give this show a 3 out of 10. And it's not even this was a bad show.
Yeah.
This was not a great show. It was just a show. And that to me is sometimes even worse than a really awful show that at least is fun to watch. This was just it was fine. And that's the best I can say about it.
It's a show that I anticipate nobody clicking on the WWE Network, except for people who might listen to this podcast.
We might be the only ones to register any hits on this particular event on the network.
I just can't see any reason anybody would want to go back to watch this show. I give it about 2.5 out of 10.
All right. Wei is going to get going, and then I'm going to conclude with feedback. But for next time on the show, Wei, we are going to be back in 2 weeks, which will be December the 9th, Friday, December the 9th. And, of course, with Bill Goldberg extending his stay with the WWE, we want to make it a Bill Goldberg-focused event, at least with him a big part of it. And we took to Twitter and put a poll up earlier this week, and our three options were when he won the U.S. title from Raven on Nitro, the surprisingly great match he had with Scott Steiner at Fall Brawl 2000, and speaking of the limousine incident with Bill Goldberg when he missed 6 months of action, he returned at the Georgia Dome Nitro in July of 99. Those were our three options, and 40% voted for the Georgia Dome return, where Goldberg came back with new theme music to Megadeth.
Oh, I wonder if that'll be on the network.
That's a great question. I wonder if it will be. So we will find out.
Yep.
We are going to review that one.
What's the date on that show?
July the 5th, 1999. Let's double check.
Is it even available on the network?
Yes, it is.
Great.
But I want to double check this date. WCW, Monday Nitro, Georgia Dome, July 99. July 5th, 99.
Great.
From the Georgia Dome. This was their first return to the Georgia Dome after the finger poke of doom.
Oh.
And what they drew 6 months apart was very telling about what that finish did to the market in Atlanta. 1 year removed from Goldberg's win over Hogan in the same stadium. Mm. So that will be our next review on December the 9th. Wei's going to take off, and then I'm coming back to take your feedback to the 2004 Survivor Series.
That's not good for Team Angle.
And Big Show, he's got so many scores to settle. So many scores to settle with Mark Jindrak, Luther Reigns, and Kurt Angle. Taz, those three men raped Big Show of his humility when they knocked him out with a tranquilizer dart and shaved his head, and then, of course, almost breaking the ankle last week.
Yeah, they sure did.
And just a few pieces of feedback here before we wrap up the show. We go to Mick Whalen. Survivor Series 2004 was a decent but not really memorable show. The Cruiserweight opener was good, even though Ray was the only one the crowd cared for. The IC title match was again good. The SmackDown Survivor Series match was okay, but Eddie eliminating Jindrak when he was not the legal man was annoying. Taker and Heidenreich was surprisingly okay, and Heidenreich and his theme was always one of my guilty pleasures of wrestling. Women's match was nothing but an angle. The WWE title match was passable, but nothing memorable. The Raw Survivor Series match was the best match on the show, but it was clear that Orton was not working as a top babyface despite being pushed as such. Who knew that it was Batista, of all people, that would emerge for Evolution as the main event babyface that everyone liked. In the end, Survivor Series 2004 is an average, unremarkable show and gets a 6 out of 10. And I would say that is maybe being generous. Christian writes, one of the things I like going in was the tease that the winning team between Team Triple H and Team Orton would be given control of Raw for each week. It might have been something small, but thought it added some interest to the match, and I did enjoy the following week's Raws, which with each person having control. This also has to be the biggest highlight of Maven's career outside of him eliminating The Undertaker. I can't think of him being in a better spot. The other thing I take away from this show was just how random JBL's entire run as WWE champion was. In terms of promos, he was killing it, but his matches and in-ring work was all over the place. I don't think many believed in Booker T as a challenger, and I don't think he was ready for that spot until he found the King Booker gimmick. And final one is from Brent Mason, who writes, we drove from Nashville to Cleveland just to get Survivor Series off our wrestling bucket list. Needless to say, this is probably one of the least memorable Survivor Series in history. The best matches of the night were the SmackDown traditional match and the IC title match. Pretty sad state of affairs when Maven is in the main story on Raw, another example of the thin roster at the time. Glad to go back and watch the infancy of Edge's heel run that would lead to Money in the Bank at the next year's WrestleMania. Thank you guys, and keep up the great podcast. All right, not a ton of feedback to this show. I don't know how much interest there was in the Survivor Series 2004, but we will be back in 2 weeks on December the 9th, reviewing the July 5th, 1999 edition of Monday Nitro from the Georgia Dome, featuring Bill Goldberg returning after a sabbatical due to injury, and lots more on that show to chat about. So we will look forward to a WCW review. And of course, there is only one thing that we can go out with, and we will have the X's accompany the most famous clip attached to Survivor Series 2004. And go check out all of our shows at liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and we will speak with you next time on Review Away.
Heidenreich! I like your poetry. And I like what you do to babies. I'll see you later. I'll see you soon, Snitsky.